is U.S. versus Flagg. Stay.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Leggins, may it please the Court. Mr. Flagg's case has, from my perspective, been a bit unusual. He was sentenced prior to the issuance of the Apprendi decision in 2000. He was actually sentenced in 1993. He completed service of his sentence and was released to supervised release. At that, almost at that point in time, Mr. Flagg is alleged to have violated the terms of his supervised release.
Same day.
he was not, unfortunately, a long-term success story. But what did happen when he violated the terms of his supervised release, we had a hearing, and in looking over the case, it hit me that there was somewhat of an unusual situation here. He received a sentence of 180 months. He was charged by an indictment pre-Apprendi, which did not list any drug amount in it. And what I saw as unusual about this is that had he been sentenced a day after the Apprendi decision, there would have been no question. His underlying offense would have been classified as a Class C felony, and he would have faced not more than 2 years of additional jail time for revocation.
But Ms. Day, I thought in his plea agreement he agreed that his relevant conduct was between 500 and 1,500 grams of cocaine base. And Apprendi does say either a fact found by a jury or, you know, agreed to by the defendant. So true enough, a jury didn't find that, but he has stipulated to that range. Why isn't that enough to take it up anyway to the higher
level? He did stipulate to that, but even with that, my understanding is that were he charged today with the with no drug amount in the indictment, there would be a statutory cap of 20 years, classifying that as a Class C felony.
The default position on the indictment, but since he has admitted to the higher level, that's the same as finding beyond a reasonable doubt that it involved that amount
of drugs, but that doesn't necessarily dictate that finds that classification a felony.
Why not?
Well, today it couldn't be, obviously, and that's the problem. Today it could not, because the indictment, if that indictment was exactly the same today, it would be a Class C felony. It's by virtue of timing. At that point in time, the court had held that if you stipulated to that, then you were stipulating to the different statutory maximum. I understand that. But that's what gets us into the issue here, is that as a result of that, when he now, post-Apprendi, went back into court and he had a sentence, and looking at the docket on this, it was difficult to tell. There were multiple defendants. All were charged by the same indictment, and it appears that all were treated differently as Class A, B, or C felonies.
Would it make any difference what the judgment of conviction says?
What the judgment of conviction says? In my mind, it would not, because
if it spelled out the statute for which he was being sentenced?
Well, it says the statute generally, because he was
under
the catch-all provision. If it said that he was being sentenced under that particular statute and the court had made a determination specifically that this was a Class A felony, I think that might give me more pause. I don't see anything other than the fact that the pre-sentence report said that it was a Class A felony.
We don't have, as far as I know, we don't have that J&C.
Right. We don't. I don't have the original judgment. One of the problems that I had is, unfortunately, this case is so old, and I didn't handle the case originally. We were trying to recreate some of the things or obtain some of the things from the record, and I apologize for that.
But it does seem that we have decisions, you know, such as United States against Wyatt, where we've said a sentence on revocation is really just part of your earlier sentence. It just modifies it. And I don't think anyone disagrees that everyone regarded the 1993 conviction as a Class A conviction.
I don't think anybody disputes that. And I recognize that Wyatt is, and that line of decisions, is the biggest stumbling block that Mr. Flagg has. But I do
think we also have these other things. I realize this is a little bit of an odd beast, but, you know, we've got other decisions like McReynolds that also say that the Apprendi rule, and for that matter, the Supreme Court's, you know, Shiro and Summerlin and other cases like that have said Apprendi wasn't that big a change. Big change, yes, but it really wasn't something so fundamental that we apply it retroactively. And you are effectively asking us retroactively to reach back, change the nature of that original sentence to Class C, and now cap his reincarceration, I should say, at 2 years.
And not that I cannot say that the courts haven't anticipated that this might be a problem down the line, but with the exception of the Hamler and the Moody courts out of other jurisdictions, this hasn't apparently been a manner, this hasn't been looked at in that manner. We have all apparently been going along pretty much assuming supervised release, it was a Class A felony, let's go ahead and sentence the revocation as a Class A felony. But I think that the door, the entry point for that is an argument of substantive due process, which, as the Marshall Court indicated, I think Marshall is cited to in the government's brief, is an elusive doctrine. It's not something anybody can easily wrap around. But I think that what it essentially says, it's a judicial-made doctrine that, you know, sometimes you look at this and you say, I understand what we've done procedurally throughout, but this isn't a case where we want to put form over substance, because the substance of what's going on here really is inherently wrong.
Why is it wrong? I mean, in a sense, I mean, as the government argues in response to this point of yours, you're complaining that his new sentence is too long. You know, why isn't that covered by something like the Eighth Amendment or covered by the due process clause, even not the substantive part? I mean, substantive due process is something the Supreme Court has tried to handle very carefully, because otherwise, you know, you could just sort of go around doing whatever you were in the mood to do on any day.
And understandably, this would be a much easier case if I could say that it fits squarely within a constitutional provision such as cruel and unusual, which the government references, the Eighth Amendment. But it really doesn't fit neatly into any of those. And the substantive due process was actually more aimed towards those cases in which there is not a specific constitutional provision which covers those areas. And I think that, again, that's the Marshall decision of the Supreme Court, which says that substantive due process is least applicable when a provision of the Constitution directly addresses the subject. We don't really have a provision of the Constitution which directly addresses this particular issue.
Well, the jurisprudence that addresses it, though, is in a sense retroactivity jurisprudence. And I take it you're not making a general attack on that, but if we agree this is really just a procedural change and we're supposed to view the sentence as something that was established at the time it's handed down, it's not like it's a Gideon problem, it's not like it's some
Correct.
Issue that undermines the sentence at a more fundamental level, you're actually asking for, in a sense, some new retroactivity rule.
It would be a very limited one, only in that particular arena of cases which are impacted by basically the oddity of setting a specific time to change this. And I say oddity, that may not be the best word. I mean, clearly the Supreme Court issued their decision on a particular day, and that's been decided since then that was basically procedural and that we would not go back and address the original sentences in those cases. But this is an offshoot of that, but I think it creates a bigger problem and one that calls for attention by the court, that we are going to keep doing this. These defendants are now getting out, and if you were sentenced in 1999 and you get out of custody the same day as somebody who was sentenced in 2001, you commit the exact same violation of the law, you go in front of the exact same judge, and in one case, the judge says, I am constrained by a maximum sentence of 2 years, and that's what I'm going to give you. And in the next case, he says, well, you know, I would have given that guy more time, and I can do it in your case, and you're going to get 5 years. There is something inherently wrong about that situation. And that's where I think the issue or the door of the substantive due process argument opens this and would allow this court to resolve that problem. And I think it's a problem that needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, we haven't had to, and Now I'm here trying to. But I do think it's important. I also think that the rule of lenity was mentioned briefly in our brief, and I think that that's also significant here and should be weighted in favor of this particular defendant. Do I have rebuttal time, or did I just use my whole 10 minutes?
You just used the whole time.
Okay. Can I say one additional thing? I spoke with Mr.
You want to do it in rebuttal, or you want to do it now?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said I didn't
no,
have
you
any.
You are finished, but
okay,
I'll give you some time to come back.
I thought you said I didn't have any rebuttal time. Thank you.
Mr. Liggins.
Good morning. This court really made most of the points that I was going to make during my oral argument. I think the strongest, and I agree with counsel, but the government's strongest argument in this case is that supervised release is and has always been considered by this court to be part of the original sentence. And if you look at this case from that aspect, then this defendant did have an avenue for avoiding this situation. He should have attacked his sentence directly. He did not do it, and now we are left with the situation in which the court found itself. From the record, it indicated that the PSI said this was a Class A felony. The court would have adopted that finding and would have then imposed a sentence consistent with that finding upon revocation of supervised release. I disagree with counsel that there aren't any, that this is an ambiguous provision for purposes of substantive due process. I think there are constitutional provisions which would cover this situation. And for those reasons, I would ask this court to affirm the sentence that the district court imposed.
I take the government also has no copy of the original sentencing order?
No, Your Honor, we do not.
JNC, it would be in the record in
prison.
In Benton, I suppose. Was it Benton or East St. Louis?
This was a Benton division case. I was not the attorney on the case.
We can find it, though. At least the clerk's office can find it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll give you another minute to stay.
Thank you. I had only one brief additional point to make, and I spoke with Mr. Liggins about this morning before court. I, in reviewing the briefs on Friday and doing a little additional research, I realized we had made an argument on reasonableness, and obviously that is not the mainstay of our case in this particular case. But we had raised this as a reasonable standard of review, and the government had mentioned the possibility of a plain error standard of review. And I simply came across this court's opinion in United States versus Castro-Juarez, which is at 425 F3rd 430. 2005, where it appears in dicta that this court has suggested that it would be plainly unreasonable, that standard would apply post-Booker as opposed to plain error standard. And that was the only addition that I had.
Thank you, Ms. Day.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Case is taken under advisement.